Hi, welcome back. Hope you've enjoyed in the meantime. And thank you, Anne. Anne sent me a picture of a Chinese trompe l'oeil. It's really, really very beautiful. If you're looking at a want to look at a really beautiful example of things appearing in a way that they don't actually exist, it's a wonderful example. Any trompe l'oeil is, but this one by a Chinese artist doing a woman standing on a ball on a tree, and it just appears as if there's the bottom of the tree, the top of the tree, and she's three dimensionally in the middle, and there is no tree. But of course, she's just two dimensional on a piece of paper pinned onto a tree. But it's really rather remarkable. So thank you for that one. It's really very good. Okay, I'll just start with refuge lines to set the motivation. Sangye chodang soki chonam la jangchu badu dakni kyabsu shi dage chunyen gi pe sonam gi drola panchir sangye drupa jo Sangye chodang soki chonam la jangchu badu dakni kyabsu shi Dage chunyen gi pe sonam gi drola panchir sangye drupa jo. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Thank you. In that spirit, let's enter into the topic. Just so again, I think just before we start, because there was that opportunity, both in our any formal meditation sessions you were doing, or as you were walking around, just trying to glance and see if you could catch a bit that arising of the sense of I that appears to exist in a way that it doesn't, but is nonetheless quite strong, and following the fifth Dalai Lama's reflections on it, the one that sometimes seems to arise in the context of thought, sometimes feelings, sometimes bodily sensations, sometimes feeling tones or whatever. It can arise out of any combination of what we might experience as a result of the five senses, mental consciousness, the aggregates, So, were there any thoughts, or if there aren't, it doesn't matter. But if we can go on. But if there was anything you wanted to share, or if you think, well, maybe I'm not quite clear about what it is, then it's worth getting clear, because I think the extent to which what we're going to do between now and Tuesday will have any impact, really sort of start to make a difference, because. Is the extent to which you can actually experientially identify this one and be clear about it relatively, as certain as one can be, rather than it just being an intellectual idea. And the power, I mean, who knows? We're human beings with infinite potential, and it could be possible that at any time we could have some very profound realizations, but it may be that we don't, but if we, I think if we work hard, we get some degree of insight, some degree of, beginning to move in that way. And if you look at all the great masters of the Madhyamaka, they all, one way or another, at some time or another, have said, this one, that sense of I that you really think exists as it appears in a way that it actually doesn't. If you just get one little doubt about it existing in the way that it appears, that's just so precious, because it'll never leave, because it just one doubt. Oh, it's not quite the way I thought it was, not in respect of a trompe l'oeil or an optical illusion, but one's sense of self. So it's really, really important.
Oh
To
yeah,
get
would you
that
like to...
insight, as it.
Sorry, Roy. Didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, it's fine. It's
Oh yeah, would you like to unmute and lower your hand and ask your question or comment?
Yeah. Thank you so much. Roy, it's more sort of following the experiential, you know, the feeling of this I. Do you know why, and I guess from what I heard, if you, you know, quite a lot of people kind of feel that the I, when we identify, is it the most present either in a heart chakra or somewhere here or somewhere in sort of, you know, around the throat, the do you know why would that be? Like, what's, because I hear a lot that that's where, you know, you most feel it. And I also myself, when I have this feeling of I, that's where it's concentrated, somewhere here or here. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know about most, you know, I don't know about, I don't know, I mean, crikey, there are a lot of human beings on the back of the planet. And also I think a bit, you know, what seems to have been more my own observation is it's a bit like the, as the fifth Dalai Lama described it, at different times, it may appear to arise or feel as if it's in different places. But if we're thinking about people saying, well, you know, I and other people I talk to have a lot of feeling, say, about it being here, I can kind of get that one in the sense that if you kind of wake up in the morning, and why I say wake up in the morning, it could be at any other time where you might have a situation where you're not sort of fully engaged with everything going. It could also be if you'd, you know, after a meditation session, or if you'd been, you know, relaxing somewhere or whatever. But when you get up in the morning is a good place to start. If you don't get up too quickly, you know what I mean? And you think about it. You don't actually, I'm going to have to describe it with words, but you might not, it doesn't always, this doesn't mean that kind of conceptual activity is going on. But there's when you wake up, how you feel, yeah, might depend on whether you leap into the day enthusiastically, feeling really good, or feel there's something not quite right, and then you might end up phoning the doctor or taking medicine or whatever, you know. And where's that coming from? There's right here, you know, in the center where your core temperature is, there is a kind of a feel-good factor barometer. And if you feel good there, you kind of feel all right. If you're out of kilter there, it's not so good. So I think there is some kind of, there's a level, kind of instinctive level. And one teacher, he's Drukpa Kagyu, but a Dzogchen teacher, a son of Tulku Urgen Rinpoche, Sokni Rinpoche. He talks a little about a practice which is called essence love. And it's about feeling there, you know, because there's this kind of, whoa, your sense of all rightness and sometimes a bit beatific is kind of there. So if you're resting there, and it is a somewhat deeper level than their normal sense of self, then it's going to arise there. But a lot of times I find, when I speak with other people, they also say yes, but of course it's not that it's in one place or the other. We find it in different places at different times. There's this idea, and this one's probably acculturated in the sense of maybe you need to be a Westerner or someone that's had a Western education and conditioning, but there's this sense that I'm some kind of driver just behind my eyes. I'm in here somewhere, no, sort of like this, yeah. And then it's typified by the fact if you know, I bet if I was to go wander along the street on one of those funny television things and say to people, "Where's your mind?" You know, they'd be going here. Whereas if I did it in the Tibetan community in India or in Nepal or in Tibet itself, they'd go here. So there's a heart mind. There's a very good piece in, going back to talking about, we were speaking about Mahamudra earlier, in the Gelagkagyu Mahamudra by His Holiness, translated with like a big introduction by Alex Berzin. Alex speaks about the translation of terms from Sanskrit and Tibetan, and explaining how we understand. So if we say the nature of the mind, then we need to bear in mind where we think the mind is and how it relates and how we're conditioned with that. Whereas someone with another cultural conditioning will feel it another way. Yeah. And then just what you're talking about, because I'm paying attention to what I'm saying and I'm looking at you, I can hear the sound of my own voice rather strong. So I kind of appear to be here. And I've already made gestures about it being silly to be behind my eyes. So, you know, the ego's got out of there already and kind of rests, that sense of self is resting in the sound and in a bit of feel good because it's nice and warm at the moment. But then the knees, yeah, there's a kind of a sense there too. If I start going there, then my sense of self becomes much more physical, you know, tied to particularly bodily sensations, and the voice has lessened. So am I making sense? It's like when you see the wonderful quote from the fifth Dalai Lama, it's great, but also, you know, academic Western translators have translated it. So it gets a bit conceptual and psychological in the Western academic sense. But what he's pointing at is this is the shifting experience of where our kind of sense of gravity in terms of our feeling of ourselves is. Well, wherever it is and however it arises, that's the one, when it arises, that we think, that's me, and that it exists, and that it exists, that's, you know, at least a correct deduction, but then we think it exists the way it appears and the way it feels, and of course, not like that. And then we add to that in our upbringing, education, particularly if we get into maybe tertiary study of philosophy or psychology, and then we add all sorts of things to it. And so, yes, it's like this. Or if we've got a very strong religious belief, you know, it's an immortal soul that is goes on forever and unchanging and so on and so on. So it's fascinating. But I think really to get to a point where you can have some realization and for it to actually be powerful in terms of opening up the possibility of seeing ourselves as we really are, it's to try and use whatever we can understand conceptually about it to feel our way into it experientially. Does that make sense?
Thanks very much, Olya. Do you want to say some more?
No, thank you. That was really good. Yeah.
It was a great question because it gets right into the heart of what the fifth Dalai Lama was talking about. Yeah.
Thank you, Olya. Anne, you had a question, I think, yes? If you'd like to unmute yourself.
It was actually a comment. It's the meditation I did directly after this morning's session. I tried to do what you said. Now, previously, I've always seen the eye as solidifying because of what was coming from outside, like people's opinions, the eight worldly dharmas, that sort of thing. Mm. And that sort of set it all. But I thought previously that was what it was, that everything that I conceived, I'm not explaining this very well, but everything that I thought of as I was actually just a reflection from outside. But then I asked myself, was there anything separate from that, as I think you told us to? And there was, definitely. And but the really weird thing, this is really, really weird, for me, it wasn't in the body or the mind. I tend to think energetically anyway, but it was sort of just an insubstantial stick, basically. I suppose a stick of light or something, which was just sort of there floating, which is really, really weird. I don't know where that came from. Anyway, I'm just sharing it as a strange idea.
We have the experience and, you know, we interpret it and describe it in different ways as it appears to us. Yeah. So I think it's great to share that, but it's just where we're sort of trying to get to is to say, however it appears, or on whatever basis it arises, when we have it strongly, we tend to assume that it exists in a way that it doesn't. We tend to assume things about it that are not really true. And when things happen that kind of shake that view, we're kind of unnerved. you know, it's like the rug's being pulled out. You know, there's a sense sometimes of, you know, it's like a, if you were climbing and started falling off. You know, some people say, oh, you know, there's a kind of almost a fear of falling at that point. And some very good teachers will say, oh, that's bad news. The good news is there is no floor. Just let go, you know, you're still there. So yeah, that's it can come up in all sorts of different ways, and it can be envisioned and experienced in different ways. But that's it's that character. And also there are times where we are almost on autopilot, where we have very, very little sense of it at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like if anybody were to say at the time, you know, who are you or where are you? There'd be a bit of a start where you've got your act together. What do you mean? Or, you know, whatever it is. And however it is, that's the one that is interesting when you talk about the kind of outside and the reflections of outside. Of course, that one, because of the way it appears to us, that's the one where we think, oh, we're terribly concerned about how other people see us.
Yeah.
That's not right. That's right. Oh, I don't like that. Oh, I do like this. There's one that's being defended there that you feel very strong about, that you're very certain about. That's the one. Yeah. And of course, with the fifth Dalai Lama's piece is talking about how it arises experientially within our own body and mind. But of course, that very sense of self is also conditioned by and dependent on how we think others see us.
Yeah.
That's another part of its basis, you know.
Mm.
It's like.
But previous to this meditation, I thought that my sense of I was all coming from outside. What I saw this time was that it was something that was latching on to.
Mm. Yeah, I think if you certainly look to, if you look to people, you can find it with people who have had perhaps traumatic experiences or very unusual experiences, or maybe experience with psychotropic drugs, or not all kinds of drugs, but psychotropic certainly, where the sense of the dissolution of the ordinary sense of self, of the normal sense of self, usually they find it frightening. Once they experience it, there's often, if you look at the descriptions for whatever reason that it occurred, there's following that a sense of liberation, you know, a sense of freedom. And I'm still here, and that wasn't quite who I thought I was. You know, there's initially, of course, you're right, because we hold on very tightly around it. We defend it. It means an awful lot to us. We kind of hang on, grasping away. So the invitation to let go sometimes can be, oh, you know, it's a bit, a little bit scary, you know, rug coming out from underneath. But I think once, you know, if you have the doubt, and then the meditation leads you to a place where it kind of lessens, yeah, and you can just breathe your way into any fear, then the experience can be unbelievably liberating. To actually begin to see how you really are, as opposed to just assenting to existing in the way that it appears at any given time. So yeah, thanks for sharing that. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Anne. Olya, would you like to ask, unmute and lower your hand? And
thank you. Sorry, I don't mean to hijack, but just wanted to quickly share something that came to my mind in relation to Anne's comment as well, and experience. Jiddu Krishnamurti is the Indian philosopher who I found gave an interesting example to that, how we perceive things. So basically he was saying that you know, one of his someone that he knew experienced a vision of a Buddha, or you know, at some point externally. So, and he was saying that you experience things internally and externally, including visualizations, as your mind is accepting, or the way that your mind is conditioned. In other words, for example, if you strongly adhere into Catholicism, you might have a revelation in the form of Jesus or Mary. It's because your mind is geared up to actually perceive this the transcendent through that lens. And the same way, so if you feel you perceive yourself as a stick, so that's how your condition is, your condition, basically the condition of your mind is able to perceive the experience that is coming within or within you. So I just wanted to share, because I thought it's quite an interesting sort of reflection on how different the perceptions can be, but also explaining why we are so different in how we perceive things inside and outside.
Yes, I think so. It's a beautiful insight. You know, Krishnamurti for me was an amazing teacher, an amazing man. I mean, to have, you know, on the one hand, rejected what the very well-intentioned Theosophical Society set up for him as being the next world teacher, and say, no, not at all. But to just single-mindedly pursue his inquiry without dogma brought benefit to just so many people, and he had so many astonishing insights. But I really think anybody who wants to think a little bit about it, what you're saying, that you sort of was opened up in you by him, was, yes, of course, this is, it's like the way we are, including our conditioning. It's like when we were talking, you know, earlier yesterday about the different ways different living beings can perceive because of the different structure of their perceptive apparatus, if you like, and radically different conceptual apparatus, if any, then that sort of opens up a very interesting relativity between, you know, the kind of value, ontological value, that we put on the way that we actually see the world. And this is another one, the culturally conditioned one, that if there's an experience that occurs that might be up to that point in time completely out with our usual range of experiences, you know, then in the same way that my mind and everybody else's mind will try to cover the gap in continuity by making it appear as a piece of paper rather than a whole, it does the same. So it's good trying to make sense of its experience. It'll bring all sorts of things to it, relative to it. And I'm wholly with that, that people will experience, you know, what they call the divine or whatever it is, in particular ways that are going to be heavily kind of loaded by their upbringing, cultural conditioning, and so on. So, yeah, I think that's fascinating. There's also a fascinating one that we won't go on about because it'll take us too far away. But like the inside and the outside is a really good conventional distinction. And it's really helpful, you know, because I can say, oh, I'm talking about what I'm thinking, not something out there. But I think, like a lot of very useful distinctions, it's not that you throw them away, but you realize if you put too much weight on them, they don't really hold up. And you think, well, okay, is there any independent, inherently existing out there, as opposed to an independent, inherently existing in here? No, of course. Because anything I experience apparently out there, I couldn't experience without my experience, my perceptual and conceptual experience. Which, well, where's that taking place? Well, apparently internally, you know. there's all sorts of fascinating, this hard line between external and internal, whilst it's really useful, I wouldn't advise anybody to throw it out of the window. It's got a purpose, but it's nowhere near as hard-edged or as concrete as we think. You know, sometimes if I'm talking about meditation and visualization, you know, I'll say, well, okay, right now I'm going to visualize Donald Duck on the top of your head. Well, you know, is it on the top of your head or is it in my mind? Where's it located? You know, to me, it appears that it's on your head. You say, no, Roy, it's in your imagination. Okay, where's that? Somewhere in here? Who knows? But you see what I mean? There's all sorts of, once we start to explore in that way, we begin to see the concrete and harder-edged natures of those otherwise useful and conventional relativities dissolve a little. And I think that's helpful. It's a great one. Yeah.
Thank you, Olya. Hello, Judy, would you like to unmute yourself and ask a question? Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's another sort of relativity is the way that we can see ourselves on different levels of subtlety. Because when you talk about being on autopilot, which I felt I was for a long time, for many years, working hard and bringing up two children, I just think that was on a very, very gross level.
Mm.
And it's only now that I've got more time and I can go inward and meditate that I can appreciate, actually, there are different levels of subtlety to my eye.
Yeah. Very much so. Because it's, again, that's the idea that when we use the word I, if we are, you know, completely automatic with it, there's this idea that there's something there that's always the same that we keep referring to, rather than as you've discovered for yourself that at any given time, when I use the word I may be referring to many, many different things, especially if we look at it over time. You know, back to the fifth Dalai Lama, where's it arising? What is its basis? What are the things that go to make it up? And you've not only got that they're kind of literally different in terms of whether they be largely emotional, sensational, conditioned by external factors or whatever else. Over and above that, you've got these kind of layers of the onion, more and more subtle, more and more expansive as the kind of, if you like, the uncontemplated one that's the automatic pilot, as the one you begin to unravel when you start to explore or make that journey within, starts to look very different, and you become aware of these different layers and levels of subtlety there too. So yes, it's really, really, it's another dimension and a really good observation, and another one which kind of begins to give us really good reason to say it just even at a conventional level here, it's really not looking like it, that it exists in the way that it normally appears by habit. And I think that's the one to start undermining. Thanks for that.
Thank you, Judy. Could I ask you to mute yourself again? Thank you. And Ruth, would you like to unmute yourself, lower your hand and ask a question? Thank you.
Roy, my question is, I relate to what you were saying very strongly about the eye having been behind the eyes, because I have that sense an awful lot that it's almost like a brick wall or something, or something that's there, and it almost feels like a disposition that I have, if you like. And I'm not sure how those two relate, for one thing, I and a disposition. But the other thing that's just occurred to me is that another way of describing it is I've often thought that this is like the observer in me.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the difference between the I and the observer and the disposition would be, if you like. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. It's a fascinating one. And I also think your experience is, and mine of that one in the same way, is really quite a common one. I mean, I don't know whether they still go, but, you know, when I was a kid, and I mean a kid, not a young adult, I used to love, you know, comics. And there was some comics always had these sort of cartoons of little cartoon characters that lived in the head. There's a kind of a driver one, and others would run around doing things. And they were all the numbskulls, I think they were called, in the comic that I was reading. So that kind of, you know, cartoon expression of it, I thought, yeah, it does. Sometimes we kind of think it feels like that, you know. Oh, I'm losing control, or I'm doing this, especially if we're, you know, doing art or writing or something like that. It's like getting everybody together and you're behind here, you know, the fat controller doing all the stuff. So I kind of relate to that. And sometimes when I catch myself there, I think back to the numbskulls. I think, yeah, it's fascinating the way that's kind of there. Disposition, if we've got a disposition, for whatever reason, you know, we can argue nature and nurture for a long time, but it part conditioned and part innate, who knows what. What's for sure is it will be some you know, in Buddhist five aggregate terms, it'll be something to do with our compositional factors, our karma, i.e. our past actions, which have consequences that give us the dispositions that we do, and other things that kind of impact on us that are related to it. So if we have a disposition, again, that is another kind of factor on which our I is designated. Yeah? When we say I, that's also a part of it. So again, not this kind of immutable, immortal, independent, partless, completely self-sufficient thing existing from its own side. Yeah, fascinating.
And the observer, is that?
The observer, it depends, if you see what I mean. The dependence there, sorry, I should have picked that up, because it's probably the biggest one. Biggest one in terms of, well, you know, some of the most profound implications there. Sometimes, see, I could say, well, I'm observing the bowl, you know, I'm observing the bowl, I'm looking at the bowl, or now I'm looking on the Zoom screen. So there's a sense of observer, which is tied up with my eye. Yeah,
that's what I feel.
But whatever comes up, whatever's doing, whatever's changing, yeah, there is an awareness of that. So in order for me to say, I am looking at the bowl, I'm observing the bowl, yeah? Wordlessly, there's an awareness of the bifurcation. What's that?
The awareness.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, I feel a bit like I'm stuck with it. It's a strange thing.
Just come back to resting in the awareness.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just, I think to get a bit further with that, it's like, you notice when I was leading us into the shamatha, when it came to placing the attention on the breath, yes, I was trying to come away from the placing the attention on the breath language to say, be present in the breath. And I'm doing that quite deliberately to try and loosen that sense of hard bifurcation.
Okay.
Yeah, when you're beginning to teach someone the meditation in that way, can be a really, really, really good idea to say, you here, watch the breath there. You are watching your breath. Oh, you got the idea. You know what your attention is, and you're watching the breath. But of course, where's the attention? It doesn't have any substance or location. It's somehow where my consciousness focuses on. Yeah. And then there's this thing like my breath, or that it's really the sensations of the breath in the body. So you have this subject object. And of course, in the shamatha process, what you're trying to do by getting attentional stability and balance, and then deepening the concentration, if you look at the levels of development of shamatha, in the end, these two become one. There is no I.
And that's when the eye disappears.
There is no object, but there is awareness. Yes, it's not that you'll pass out at that point. The ordinary sense of eye may disappear, but it's more in the way of being a black in rather than a black out. Yeah. So what I'm saying is, whatever goes on, whenever we think, oh, I'm unsure, you know, me, the observer, or whatever else, don't ever forget, and you can't get away from it, however far the infinite regress goes, if you like, there is always awareness. It's not to do with words. It's not to do with conception. It's not to do with feelings. But there it is. Everything that takes place.
So is it that sense of letting go, if you like?
Yeah.
You're holding on too tight? You need to
let go of that.
Okay.
It's like you won't. The awareness won't disappear.
Yeah.
In fact, it might become more vibrant. It might become.
Yeah.
But if you look, maybe we go too far away, but it's another place to go look. If you go look for, say, Buddhist psychology, they'll say, well, actually, there are only three things you can say about the mind. It's empty, it's clear, lucid. Clarity and lucidity, the same here, and cognizant or knowing. Doesn't have any other attributes, doesn't have a location, doesn't have a colour, doesn't have a shape. Clear, empty, knowing, just like that. So you can rest, forgive the Tommy Cooper expression, but you can just rest there. If you're getting confused about, oh, me here and all the rest of it. And similarly with the shamatha, once you've got the idea, in order to begin, you kind of lift up what metaphorically one part of the mind and get it to focus on another. But once you get past that stage, you can just rest the awareness, the presence, the attention in the sensation. And already then that sense of bifurcation is softened. You're aware, you're focused, you're single-pointed, you're alert in the rhythm of the breath in the body, and you're no longer like you looking at something from a distance or being the scientific observer. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I feel like it's happening now a bit.
Yeah.
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 Interesting. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth. Could I ask you just to mute yourself again, please, Ruth? Thank you. Are there any other questions or comments that anyone would like to? Amanda, yeah, would you like to unmute and ask your question? Thank you.
Hi. Something I found useful from the book that we're working with is just a couple of sentences the Dalai Lama said. That I've used for a long time now and continue to find it useful when I reflect upon it, is that we have two selves. There's a self that lives, experiences, creates karma, understands what's going on around it, and there's the other self, which needs identifying and negating. And this is the idea that Rory's talking a lot about. So Dalai Lama puts it in that sense, that there's two eyes. So that we're, I suppose, because we're not going to negate our whole self, you know, how we live our life and where we're up to. But Venerable Chogron says about the eye that we're trying to find is so ingrained, it's so, she calls it innate, she means it on the conventional level, it's an innate sense of self that's ignorant, and then through learnt ignorance, the other layers that come on through our life, we might have had family that, you know, they were a prince or a princess, you're so wonderful, you're so marvellous, well, that adds to our false perceptions of our sense of self, that ultimately I think makes it more difficult to find this I. But Venerable Chogron recommends that you find it in a state of quite strong emotion, particularly if somebody's criticizing you, I think you'll find it rise. You know, that sense of how dare they say that to me, and how dare they think that about me, you know, that sort of area that we occasionally go to as Buddhists. I realize we might not go there very often because we're working on ourselves, but it's still there. It'll be there for, well, and until we've really worked our way up through the jhanas. Until we're a yogic direct perceiver, we're going to have this sense of I, and it's difficult to find it.
Yeah. No, all very good learnings and observations. There's a conventional I, if you like, and then the ultimate nature, that's seeing ourselves as we really are. And that conventional I, if only we could see it as conventional. It's what's sometimes called the mere I. Nothing more, nothing less. It's like when I say, Roy, you know, I mean this lot sitting here. And there's no problem with that. In fact, how could we communicate otherwise? It's if you can just treat it as a kind of a self-referring indexical pronoun that says, oi, over here, this one, it's not a problem for us. But if we think it's more than that, or something that exists outside of the mind-body complex, or something that's not dependent on anything else, then part of the direction that we're taking here with this meditation is to see that that one really can't exist at all. It's just a fantasized way of existing. So that I think that one's really, really important. And also because, and it's going back to that point we were making earlier about if we suddenly realize that we don't exist in the way that we appear to exist, that doesn't mean we don't exist. Of course, we still do, but not in the way we thought we did by assenting to the appearance alone. And the Venerable Chodron, she is a really wonderful teacher, and she's right on the money with the we explored it a little bit in the run-up to this morning's meditation and a little bit in it, that one of the ways, if you're having a problem thinking, well, you know, I've got the idea of this right, but how do I really experience, not just intellectually but experientially, this sense of self, then the traditional prescription is indeed to say, remember a time that somebody falsely accused you. Remember a time where somebody accused you of doing something you didn't do. And there's an immediate kind of strong reaction, yeah, that up it comes. And it's a very, very strong sense of self, you know, albeit a negative one. You could also choose very positive ones. You know, we all have certain achievements in life where we've just gone, yes, you know, wow. Then the sense of self is really, really strong. There's no doubt about it then. So if you're in meditation and you're trying to do some analytical meditation and it's a bit dry, a bit arid, a bit conceptual, then you can spend some time trying to connect with memories of those strong appearances of the self, because they've usually made a very strong imprint, and it'll come flooding back, and then you've got it. You know, it's then something very real, not some rather academic sounding thing called the object of negation. You know, it's kind of, but you can understand what that means then. So yeah, she's pointing in exactly the right direction, and it's where I was hoping we'd be going here, because before we go on to the next part, to be clear about that and have some idea about it is really important, because the rest of the analysis we're going to do is kind of analyzing that one. And if you've got a very strong sense of that one and a strong understanding of it, then the rest of it's much easier. Otherwise, it can become airy-fairy, confusing, or merely conceptual. And she's also really, really right to point out that the sense of self has got a quite a big innate chunk, which is then reinforced by cultural conditioning, learning, education, or can be reinforced by philosophical speculations or religious belief. You know, if that one is added to by somebody saying you have an unchanging, permanent, immortal soul, then that adds to that, you know, oh, it's completely just, that's just the way it is, you know. So that the conditioned and the innate work together. And then over a long time, but you know, we know what habit, we know how hard it is to break even small bad habits. But the sense of self is a really big habitual one. And it's almost a no-no, a taboo. Nobody wants to go there, really. Well, we all do. We wouldn't be here. But we're hardly, you know, the majority of the human race. It's not a popular sport, unfortunately. But there are some brave souls that are prepared to have a go. I'm very pleased to see. So, yeah, no, I think it's wonderful. And we're there we are. Anyway, I don't think there's anybody confused or missing the mark. So should we move on a little? Okay. So if we come back to the posture, find a nice comfortable posture. And we'll start to look at the second step. There's four steps in this process of doing this kind of analytical meditation. So as always, we kind of come back to the experience of the five senses of mental consciousness. It's kind of letting everything else go, letting it be just as it is, not trying to block anything out or suppress anything, chase after anything. If we are identified with our own experience or somehow confused about it, just treat it as a distraction. Gently bring the attention back to the experience of the five senses and mental consciousness. Just looking to be still in body, speech and mind with the senses vividly alive. And pick up the rhythm of the sensations of the breath in the body. Rest there. Just be present in the tide-like ebb and flow of the sensations of the breath in the body for a moment or two. And when you've got a bit of stability and balance, just gently let go of the breath as an object. You can always go back there if it becomes confusing or uncertain. You can just go back to the anchor of the sensations of the breath in the body. Regain that balance and stability, let go, and begin the meditation again, or resume where you left off. Because you don't want any of the analysis to disturb too much the balance, stability, or serenity of the attention. But on the other hand, if you don't go there a little bit, we just rest there and we don't develop any insight. So see if, first of all, we can just go over the first step again. And that's really close to what we've just been talking about. That's kind of identifying the target of the analytical meditation, you know, the source of our innate and habitual beliefs and feelings about ourselves, the reified I, if you like, and the one we habitually assent to existing in a way that it doesn't. Maybe because of what we've been doing, we're just there, we connect with it. But if it's at all difficult, then just go back. Think of one of those moments where you were outraged that somebody accused you of something that you haven't done, or you were just over the moon about something you'd achieved. Just see if you can connect with that. If you don't already, you know, it may be just the way we've been talking about it and focusing on it, there may already be a kind of a clear idea of the experience of self that we're talking about. You can kind of recall a bit the words of the fifth Dalai Lama, you know, about it. Sometimes it seems to exist in the context of the body, sometimes in the context of the mind, sometimes in the context of the feelings, discriminations, or other factors. We come to identify this sense of I that appears to exist in its own right, something that we feel from the start is kind of self-established. It's pervading and undifferentiated with the mind and body. I think he says like milk and water. Having got that sense again, bring the attention back to the gates of the senses. Just check out mental consciousness, simplify things, drop down out of the head into the body. Place the attention again on the felt somatic sensations of the body. Pick up the rhythm of the breath in the body. Get some balance, stability, and serenity on that. Drop it as the object of your attention again. When comfortable, just start to pay attention to your feelings. Both, you know, you can pay attention to physical sensations or emotions and emotional tones, or maybe some of those more subtle sensations of well-being, or maybe not feeling quite right in any way. Or it might be that when we go there are no kind of emotional tones currently present in the experience that stand out. That's kind of fine too. And if they're absent, it may be that their absence is a result of a sort of numbness. So check out for a moment whether there are any thoughts associated with it, whatever sensations or emotions you're experiencing at the moment. There's often a kind of a connection between conceptual thoughts, emotions, and the physical and more subtle sensations. So just check out, is there any chatter going on around those feelings, whether they be sensations or emotions or the numbness? Whatever you've got, just rest in that with a gentle tranquility. Don't suppress it or try to correct it or modify it. Just be with it. Don't try to do anything with it. Just rest there, gently bringing your attention back if distracted by anything else, internal or external. Then gently let's do a little bit of analysis, sort of analyze the appearance of the reified eye, this identified sense of self. And we can start to consider the relationship between the sense of self, you know, that which we think the eye is referring to, and the basis of it. You know, what's the basis when we say I? What is it that we're referring to at that point in time? Our sense of ourselves is inextricably involved with our mental and physical aggregates. And what I is for us refers, what it refers to in our experience is some combination of aspects of our mind and body. That's kind of what's meant when you see in the literature, you know, the idea of the basis of designation of self or I, sort of like it's kind of academic language, basis of designation. Sounds rather grand, but it's just, you know, what's the I referring to? And what's coming up that we're saying, oh, I, it's this combination of things, basis of designation. So any intelligent estimation of what we are has to kind of come to terms with the fact that it arises in the context of being a psychophysical organism, you know, being a mind and a body. So in particular, if the self kind of solidly and as concretely exists as we think it does, you know, in the way that it appears, then you can bring a bit of logic into play and say, well, either it's one with mind and body or different from them. It's good to be clear about the logic in a way, but it's quite simple that these are the only two possibilities. You know, what others could there be? I mean, we can say, well, maybe it's a combination, but yes, and that's, if it's not mind and it's not body, then is it not the mind and the body? Whichever way you look at it, it's either this one that we're referring to, it's either one with mind and body or some aspect of mental or physical experience or some combination of it, or it's separate, different, same or different. And the application of this same or different based on the logic of identity means there's no three ways about it. But it's worth thinking about that. No good accepting it just because I say so, or we read it in some logic textbook, or even that it's what the Buddha said. It's worth thinking, because if you doubt the logic, if you think there's a hole there, this is the second step. In the same way, the first step, if you can't properly get a hold of this sense of self, then there's no reality there to base the analysis on. And if for some reason you say, oh, well, I'll suspend judgment and go this way, or just accept it because somebody says so, then should it start to become a little unnerving, you might say, oh, well, no, I don't really believe the logic. It's not right. I'm not convinced, and so on and so forth. So it's good to just think a moment about that. So hang on. Yeah, if there is one like this, then it either exists as a part of, pervading mind and body, one and the same, in some way or another, some sense of identity, or it's different. Only two possibilities, no three ways about it. So worth pondering those parameters. And you can do that actively. You can think, is there a way for the I that appears to be kind of self-established in the context of the mind and body complex to kind of exist other than as a part of or separate from mind and body. If it inherently exists independent from its own side, as it seems to, it must surely be either one with or separate from mind and body. Just think about that for just a little bit. And see if you can let that go. Come back to your experience right here, right now. Not a past experience or anything else, just right here, right now. Start to ask yourself whether the felt sense of I that appears to be inherently here, self-established in the context of our experience of mind and body. Could it have a way of existing other than either being a part of or separate from our mind and body? It's not either a part of or separate from mind and body, what other sort of existence could it have? Just rest there with that question for a moment or two. Gently, but coming back if distracted from it. Maybe just turn the analysis to other things, ordinary objects, cups, tables, chairs, computers, cushions, houses, mountains, whatever it is, whatever's within your purview, mentally or physically. And you can kind of reflect in the same way where they're concerned. There's no third category of existence. Either they're the same as their basis of designation, you know, i.e. what, when we say mountain or cup or table or whatever else, we're either referring to something that we call that because it's got a particular shape or particular set of attributes or particular function or a smell or whatever it is, or some combination of that. So either they're the same as that, we kind of give them those names on the basis of their parts or aggregates, or they're different from them in some way. I mean, we may think, oh, well, you know, that's silly. They can't be different from them. They are that or not at all. But logically, one can understand the idea of saying, well, yeah, but logically, either it's the same or different, even if we end up concluding that they're obviously the same. But at least the logical point is there. Either it's that or something else, not some third thing. Then come back to our own strong kind of rarefied sense of I. Think, is it like that? If it kind of exists as it appears to us, it must either be one with or separate from mind and body. Then when you've turned that over a bit, don't push it or feel you need to get an immediate resolution, just let go. Might just carry on its own at some part of the mind chattering away, but come back to the experience of mental consciousness, the five senses, and the sensations of breath in the body, and then your choice. You just rest in the sensations of the breath in the body, or let go. Just rest in completely open, choiceless awareness. Just be with whatever experience you have as a result. when you hear the sound of the gong strike, just let go. Neither meditate nor not meditate. Just relax with whatever experience you have. Anyhow, so between now and tomorrow, if you could kind of, whether you're in formal meditation session or just still within the boundaries of retreat but doing ordinary activities, just glance now and again to see if you can touch base with that reified sense of self. See if you can glimpse it, see if you or notice when it comes up, so you become more familiar with it, because that really is the essential first of the four steps. And then secondly, either in formal session, as we've done, gently run through the logic of the second step, which is kind of deceptively simple but clear, and that's a thing is either the same as itself or different. Just follows from the notion of identity. You know, there's no three ways about that one. It either is or it isn't. And think about that either in respect of self or in respect to anything else. You know, is the computer in front of me? What I'm calling the computer, am I saying this is a computer? Do I mean it's pervading this lot or it's some other thing? However silly it might sound, it's just something about the identity. If you do that gently, although you, in a formal session, you might want to do it just as we've done it, but if you find yourself tightening up around it, or it becoming, you know, a kind of an obsessive intellectual activity, just drop it. And between now and tomorrow morning, do at least one sitting session that's just straight shamatha, whether that's on an object or without an object. Don't even attempt to think about it. Really, really important to get the balance of the two, or the analysis, the activity of analysis disturbs the calm and the serenity and the clarity. So it's really, really important to keep those balanced, because it's the kind of foundation of the one that provides it the kind of wherewithal for the other one really to work well without us grabbing onto it, being carried away by it, or becoming overwhelmed by it, or bored with it, or disenchanted with it, or whatever. You know, we can very easily go off and say, oh, it's got nothing to do with meditation. So if it gets, if there's any problem with it at all, just drop it and come back to shamatha. And if you're finding it's very informal session, very, very kind of successful, you know, it's going really well, then when you get somewhere with it, make your mind up at a certain point just to drop it and return to shamatha, either on the breath or whatever physical object, or without an object and just rest. And then we'll look forward to seeing you tomorrow, and we'll have a look at the third step. We can discuss where we've got to, but between now and then, just see if you can kind of focus on those first two steps. So thank you very much. We'll do the dedication verses. And Jang Chub Sem Chorin Poshe Ma Kir Panam Kir Gujing Kir Wanyampa Me Payang Gong Ne Gong Lu Pelwa Jo Tony Tawa Rinpoche Ma ke panam ke gujing, ke pa nyam pa me pa yang, Gong ne gong du pelwa zhu. May the precious supreme bodhicitta not yet born arise. May that arisen not decline, but increase more and more. May the precious view of emptiness not yet born arise. May that arisen not decline, but increase more and more. Thank you very much. Lovely to see you. Keep enjoying and much look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Stay well, go safe.